I'm going to use very light air quotes here. Mm-hmm. No one can see this, but they're soft air quotes. This learning myth, to me, is the least mythy. Because I don't know how much it's actually something that is proposed and perpetuated. Mm-hmm. It just is something we default to often in learning activity and how we approach learning. But that's not the case for all. But it does find its niche probably dominating more often than it needs to. Welcome to the Pedagogy Toolkit. In today's episode, Cami and Alex discuss our myth takedown number 2, the modern day lecture. In some instances, this is a great methodology for learning, but in many instances, we may default to it when there might be better active learning protocols to put into place. Stay tuned.
Sorry.
We were talking about how you were, you know, what was it, funky and fresh these days, Cami? What were you watching the other day that made you think this is funky and fresh? I'm so, hip and with the youth. What
I'm
were
so
you watching?
Funky and fresh and hip with the youth. I was watching Sense and Sensibility.
Which version?
You know, I can't even remember. I love them all. And sometimes I'll watch them, like, I'll watch one version and then I'll watch the next version just to compare the versions. But I forget which version is the one that I saw this one thing in.
Yeah. Do they do the, is it like how Pride and Prejudice has the, like, a long BBC anthology of it? And then another is like a movie version?
Yeah, some of them do have that.
I'm more familiar with the Pride and Prejudice ones.
Yeah, some of them do have that. So there are movie ones, there are series ones, and there are sometimes multiples of each. Pride and Prejudice does that. You'll also notice it with Little Women. Yeah. And now Anne of Green Gables.
And then Jane Eyre.
Jane Eyre. Anne of Green Gables actually, I think, is almost always a series. I don't know if I've ever seen it as a full movie.
Hmm.
That's interesting. I didn't even think about that before.
Yeah.
So I was watching Sense and Sensibility the other day, and one of the scenes actually reminded me of a conversation we had at work. Because one of the sisters, you know, had gone out in the rain looking for her former potential suitor. And she, you know, had been heartbroken by him. So she just was looking longingly across the way at his home. But of course, she got in the rain and that made her mortally ill. And so she was in bed. The doctor came and he tried bloodletting on her. And bloodletting, if you haven't heard of it before, is just where doctors used leeches or sometimes razors to get blood out of a patient. It was supposed to release the bad blood that was causing the sickness so that potentially they could get better. It reminded me of a conversation we had the other day when you were listening to a podcast and you had this one person who I think was a guest on the podcast make kind of a startling statement.
Yes, it was actually this podcast that broke open the discussion that led to this myths takedown series that we're in right now. And it was a EdSurge podcast where they were interviewing a Nobel Prize laureate, Dr. Carl Wieman, who was a Nobel Prize winner for his work in physics decades ago, but he has since over the last many years focused more on educational research and learning theory. And he described the modern day lecture as the equivalent of academic bloodletting. So I think what he really means by that, let me just try and pull up an actual quote. The large college lecture, the cornerstone of undergraduate education in America and much of the world today, is similar to bloodletting. He says, you give people lectures and some go away and learn the stuff, but it wasn't what they learned from a lecture. They learned it from homework, from assignments. When we measure how little people actually learn from a lecture, it's just really small. And so I think the equivalent that he was making in the point and using bloodletting as the analogy is there may have been a small segment of illnesses or diseases where bloodletting might actually be beneficial or positive. But really, bloodletting back in the 19th century and then way back to ancient history was a common practice. And for the amount that it was used, the proportion of it actually being beneficial was actually really, really small. And so he's making that similar point with the college lecture. The degree to which the modern lecture is used as a default method of learning or teaching is probably disproportionate to its actual benefit that it has in the classroom and in the learning outcomes for students. It has a place and it has its needs, and we want to make sure that we're not stepping on anyone's toes who does lecture, who likes to lecture and is a good lecturer and engaging with their students and connecting with them.
So,
but there may be better learning outcome or better practices that align better to learning outcomes versus defaulting to a lecture to convey information to a student.
Right. So let's define what we're talking about when we say lecture, because lecture doesn't mean every time you get up and talk in front of your students, which is sometimes what we think of it as. There are different ways that you can lecture or convey information. And in this particular conversation, when we say lecture, we mean that one-way communication by a subject matter expert over a prolonged time that focuses on a particular subject matter or subset of topic within that subject matter. And so we're talking about kind of that, you know, if you're lecturing to your students for an hour and that is the only interaction that happens in your course.
Right. That there are ways that discussing and speaking up front to your students can be beneficial, but there might within that span of time be other ways to implement in that hour time frame rather than speaking about the subject matter for an hour. Research is showing that Dr. Wieman has done and others that there could be actual pedagogical implementations, learning activities that would supplement or complement some of that spoken lecture material in a way that enhances learning and creates more of an active learning environment that leads to the students' outcomes improving versus just the speaking about the material as that subject matter expert alone for that hour or those 30 minutes.
Right, because that's just passive learning, right? You're not doing anything with the knowledge. You're only hearing it. And sometimes, even though you may take notes, you may not even see everything that you need to see in learning that. We've talked before about learning styles, how we're all of these types of learners.
Yes.
So the audio is helpful, but also if you have other ways that students are interacting with that material, it helps them retain that knowledge and kind of implant it in their brain a little bit more than if you're just having them listen to you and do nothing with it.
Yeah. And probably another, the deeper issues at hand when it comes to, it's not that the use of a lecture is inherently bad unto itself. It's just a matter of what, how do we ensure the quality and the capability of that lecture to deliver the needed learning outcome. And so even reading more of Wieman's research, you know, there was one quote where the fact that most colleges and universities don't even bother to systemically measure teaching quality is one of the biggest problems festering in higher education. Another kind of deep dive on that was the quality of teaching is not something that university administrators are rewarded for and correspondingly know or care about. Wieman said, if the improved quality of teaching improved by 100% and that in that process reduced the amount of research funding they did and published by 1%, they would be penalized since the latter is more carefully measured and compared across institutions, whereas the former is never measured. So he kind of basically brings up the point that because of that, there's like a skewed rubric by which university instructors can sometimes be measured. And so there's not necessarily an incentive to change the pedagogical delivery system in a way that might benefit both the learner and the instructor.
Yeah.
Because that's not what the instructor or the faculty member is being encouraged to pursue most often. They're encouraged to pursue publication and research. And fair point, you're at a research university. That's part of your bread and butter. But you're also there to teach. It's a both and. And he's just saying the scales are overbalanced or overweighted on one side versus
right.
The other. That touches on a point that I think the culture and the history of academia still bears in reality today. Much of its delivery of learning and information comes from that sage on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Perspective. And there is value in that, right? There is the reality that I think is good for students to come in humbly, to want to learn from people who have been sitting in ideas and sitting in research and sitting in concepts, sometimes decades longer than you, and you have something to learn from them. At the same time, not everyone's going to learn just by listening to the sage on the stage repeat, sometimes at a very advanced level beyond the level that an incoming new student to the concept is going to be able to pick up immediately. Because sometimes when someone's been sitting in a concept or sitting in a subject matter for 10, 20, 30 years, you can forget what it's like to be new to that material and what it's like to sit into that. And so moving from providing the opportunity for someone to passively consume your knowledge to get to active learning. How do we encourage the active learning process for students? And that's what Wieman talks about. He doesn't want to see himself as a sage on the stage. He wants to see himself as more of a guide through the discovery process for students when they come into his subject matter.
What do you mean by sage on the stage?
And this is a good question. This is actually something James and a few others were tossing around recently. James brought it up, so I'm going to throw him under the bus if this comes back at us. But it comes down to the idea of mastery. What does it truly mean to have mastery of a subject? Is that even possible, truly, in any subject area? You know, I think that's where I think humility is actually of great virtue and benefit, because we all should continually be students of our subject matters and of our disciplines and what we're learning. And what I mean by the sage on the stage, and again, I'm borrowing that phrase from Wieman's research and interviews, just this idea that there is a person who holds mastery or a person who holds advanced standing and knowledge in a subject matter or discipline, and you're coming in essentially just to absorb as a sponge from that wisdom. Imagine that in any type of discipline, but I mean, I came from my undergrad in history, and that's mine. I think of it in this little anecdotal experience where I wrote down what, in my mind, if I was teaching a history class, say an American history class, and we were doing a unit on the Civil War, what would the students learn from more, and what would they retain more information from? Would it be from listening to me talk about the Battle of Antietam for 30 minutes and just jot down notes? Or would it be I create a space for half an hour where they break into groups and research, do little micro projects where they gather their information, they research what this particular general did, they research military tactics on this side, they research the weather for that day, and then they come together and put together an entire report and demonstration as a class, doing that jigsaw style of learning. And so from that even simple anecdote, I could take the route of talking for 30 minutes, and there would be some information gleaned, and there would be some learning that would take place. But by leveraging other opportunities of including different active learning practices, the students are probably going to take away more from that, because they're not just getting it from one vantage point, one person, and one delivery style. They're going to get multiple methods.
Right. And in an online course, this may look a little bit different, because sometimes in online courses, yes, you have a lecture, you have a quiz, you might have a discussion, you might not. And then you have like a multiple choice, large midterm or final or both. And so in an online course, what this looks like is breaking up that initial lecture video into micro topics, which we've talked about before.
Yes.
It could mean adding in other videos that you found helpful, maybe TED Talks or a crash course video, you know, something from PBS or BBC. There are lots of resources out there that are already built that may be talking about that same topic from a different perspective than yours, which can be helpful. Or maybe it's just defined or, you know, talked about it in just a little bit of a different way. Sometimes students connect to that a little bit.
I think honestly, too, the online perspective, even if you are very attached to the idea of lecturing because you're passionate about your subject and you know a lot about it and you want to convey that knowledge and that information, which is good. You're leveraging your expertise in a way that benefits others. That's awesome. The online space, though, provides such a more dynamic way to convey that lecture information versus when I'm face-to-face in a classroom, there's only so many ways that I can lecture about that material. Whereas, for instance, I'm working in a course right now where we're building concepts in real estate, and the instructor wants to record videos where she's speaking. She's lecturing in a sense. She's conveying basics in a one-way format, but she wants to go to different locations, to real estate properties, and to take measurements and to talk about different edifices and aspects of the home and really convey that in a way that's much more dynamic than just a talking head or just showing slides on a screen while she's standing in front of the class. And that, you know, you can deliver that in a face-to-face lecture as well if you build that material, but in an online space, it's just kind of naturally there for you. So you really have the opportunity to be more dynamic with your lectures. You don't have to, you can be sitting as a talking head. And that's beneficial sometimes because you just need that sole focus on a particular concept. But at the same time too, you can get creative. Yeah. And that could really enhance the learning.
It is good for students to see your face every now and then on a video. But also, yeah, like there are so many different ways to conceptualize this information that you are an expert in, and different ways to show people what it is that, why limit yourself? And even in a face-to-face course, you know, a flipped classroom, if you had the students, you know, go through these lectures and readings and things before they got to class so that they were prepared to do an activity, that's still one way you could utilize this online platform and be just better resource to have that dynamic moment in your classroom with this information conveyance, right? Because that's the point of a lecture, yeah, is to convey that information. And so if we can do that in a way, you know, every time we talk about this, this is how my silly brain works. But I keep thinking about vitamins and supplements because you'll have like certain ones that, let's say you have a regular vitamin C, right? You can take the vitamin C, but there are some people who would benefit because of a genetic mutation from having a liposomal vitamin C that is absorbed more through your fat than your belly. And so you have these little things that are added to vitamins or changed about their structure a little bit to make them more available and beneficial to the person who is taking them. And that's what this is. Getting rid of your lectures is just like going from a regular old vitamin to a bioavailable vitamin, right?
Or instead of just taking those vitamins, you could just bloodlet. But that's where the analogy kind of can...
Right.
We can kind of see the hilarity of it. It's, well, if we have these better alternatives, or if we have these alternatives that could really make it more dynamic and more targeted and practical for different learners or for different people based on their, you know, and you're using your analogy, this vitamin would be better for this patient or this person. But if we say, well, I'm just going to go bloodlet, it's like, but why would we default that? I don't know how that would work, but it might. Maybe it would, but it might work on a certain number of people and patients for this particular issue, but probably not most of them, and probably not in all circumstances. And so, that again, that's why Weeman uses that alarming analogy. But I think that hits right on it. Yes, there are more targeted methods and approaches, and I think this might be a little bit of a tangent, but I love the flipped classroom concept. I think, personally, so many courses, especially in the face-to-face realm, would benefit from a flipped classroom model where you as the student are doing some of the passive consumption of information on your own through the facilitation. And again, our LMSs make that so much easier now to just stack that material in a way that students can systemically work through it. Maybe they retain some, maybe they get it to an extent, but then they get to come to class alongside other learners, alongside the subject matter expert, and then really dig in and go deeper. And then obviously in online space, you're facilitating that still asynchronously. It just looks different in how you deliver it. But I'm all for these alternative delivery methods, especially as technology allows us the capability to shift the lecture into a different form of delivery in a way that really opens up more space for us to actively engage in learning during that valuable classroom time or that asynchronous learning environment.
Right. And you know, in other episodes, we have and will, again, get into the different ways that and different activities you can use to engage once students have this knowledge. But just talking about that conveyance of knowledge in general, yeah, there's so much at our fingertips right now, and even where you can put in knowledge checks to these
yes.
things where you're conveying information to make sure that students are tracking with what you're saying, to make sure they're understanding where you are. Generally, we say, you know, don't make your videos more than 10 or maybe 15 minutes if you're really pushing it.
Yeah.
So you're focusing on a specific topic, you're keeping it short and to the point, and then you may move on to another topic in a different video. But even like if you use the shorter videos, or even if you go a little bit beyond that and do a 20 or 30 minute video, adding in a knowledge check every so often.
Define every so often. What do you mean by that?
Let's say if you have a 15 minute video, add in a question every 5 minutes to the video. You can do this with the Kaltura quiz creator.
Yes.
We do have other options like H5P, but generally the Kaltura quiz creator, that integrates really well. If you want to, you can attach points to it, but this is not something where you provide feedback. So it's just a, are you tracking with me? Do you retain this knowledge? Is it implanted in your brain?
I think of this as this is when you are lecturing in a face-to-face and you're up at the board and you've been maybe talking about a concept or you're writing about a concept. You're discussing it, your back is to the students, and then you turn around and you see some blank stares. And you stop, okay, I see some confused looks, or does anyone have questions, or what are we missing here? And the students then have the chance to check in.
Right.
Do we have that feedback? Do we get that? What's happening here? You don't have that in the async environment. These kinds of knowledge checks are a way to ensure. Sometimes a student might think that they understand, and then if you insert that knowledge check, it allows them to make sure, wait, no, actually, I really don't. I need to,
right.
I need to listen to that again.
Even without a blank stare, it's just good to ask a question and throw some out because it keeps your students engaged. So that's part of it. It's kind of like getting ahead of the confusion, getting ahead of their disinterest. You're asking them to act, right? It's a call to action.
Yeah.
But also a little low stakes or no stakes in that case, yeah. Question like that. That can actually help students retain that knowledge longer, not just in the moment, but, you know, and maybe even after they've taken your quiz, maybe after that lesson or after your course.
I agree. I don't have a follow-up from
that. We have a whole podcast episode on
it. We do have, it's one of our earliest episodes on micro lectures. We have on our TIPS website.
On low-stakes testing.
Low-stakes testing, yes.
Yeah.
And micro lectures. So we're really, so really what we're saying is this podcast episode is just saying there are alternatives, and then we're also providing in other longer podcast episodes. Go find those alternatives. We go into deeper detail about how you can explore some of those alternatives. Because, again, I'll reiterate, we don't want somebody to finish listening to this and think lecture bad, must get rid of. But is it the default? Does it have to be the default in this particular unit or this particular lesson you're teaching?
My mind always takes me weird places. So I think of this as like, I automatically default to Pizza Fridays. That is my default for dinner on Friday. Every Friday, no matter what I'm doing or where I'm at, it's Pizza Friday. And then sometimes I have to stop and go, why at 40 years old is it still Pizza Friday? Like,
why not?
Also, yes, but why? Because you know what? There are better options and choices out there, right? Sometimes. Now,
barely.
But okay.
Tacos, maybe.
Quick default to Pizza Fridays. But it's like, is there, why am I automatically defaulting to that? And so just with everything in my life that I start defaulting to, I have to ask myself, why am I doing this? And is it really the best option? Now, sometimes, just like you answered, the answer is yes, Pizza Friday is the best thing ever. But sometimes I can say, you know what? I need a salad with my pizza. I need to make it salad and Pizza Friday.
Yes. Or just understanding that, you know, I'm not going to call out any specific pizza chain by name, but default big box pizza mm-hmm. chain, if that's your default on Pizza Fridays, there's
homemade pizza.
So many other options that might deliver
pizza.
Yeah, that might deliver the Pizza Friday desire.
But in a healthier box, but in a way
that's the idea of like a micro lecture.
Yeah.
You're still conveying the information in a way that makes sense to you, that allows you to demonstrate your expertise, but it freshens it up. It makes it actually more pedagogically sound for student learning outcomes to be achieved, and it allows students to engage a degree more beneficial in a way that puts them 1 or 2 degrees closer to reaching those outcomes. If your goal for Pizza Fridays is to be healthy, yeah, you're probably not going to reach that. But if you incorporate a salad, or if you swap out some ingredients and make it at home, it's probably going to be a little bit healthier. Maybe not always, but maybe sometime.
Maybe a little healthier than the big box, right? Or at least you're adding in a nutritional value, something. You're giving your body some variety there.
So it really, I think, for me, comes back to that Wieman quote that I brought at the beginning. It really just comes down to asking yourself, because maybe the lecture makes perfect sense for what you're needing to convey, but it's asking yourself the why. What is my reason for defaulting or going to this particular delivery method of my content? And are there other options out there? And so having that systemic measurement of the teaching quality that I'm delivering, that was what Wieman pointed out. Like the reality in higher ed is there's probably a opportunity out there to incentivize the ongoing improvement of teaching quality, and at least evaluation of teaching quality in the first place. Not to root anyone out, not to tear anyone down, but just to enhance and improve upon the people have the knowledge base. But just because we have the knowledge base doesn't mean we're conveying it in a way that
makes sense
or delivers it in a way that benefits the student. And it should definitely be both. We should incentivize those subject matter experts that faculty and researchers are, because they are, and we need that in the university sphere, but also students are there to learn from them. And if we could improve that marginally over time, incrementally over time, then we're creating better outcomes for the future of that discipline or the future of those students and their fields that they go into beyond it.
Yeah, I mean, most people who are teaching at the college level that I've met, they want to do good things for their students. And so this just takes the opportunity to evaluate what you're doing and say, am I allowing students the opportunity to learn actively and get the most out of their education? You know, is there more that I can be doing? I'm doing good. Can I do better?
Yeah. Am I teaching my students to bloodlet, or am I giving them antibiotics?
Yeah. Am I making their vitamins bioavailable?
Right. And again, like I'm saying, in some instances, lecturing might be the cream of the crop, might be the top deliverable outcome.
Sometimes you just need big box pizza.
And sometimes it's going to be a different, more active learning style. It's going to be more project-based. It's going to be flipped classroom. It's going to be jigsaw methodology. It's going to be micro-lecturing. There's just so many options out there. We don't need to default to
one. In general, yeah.
That one isn't.
But specifically the passive one, right?
Yes.
We don't need to default to bloodletting. We need to look at all of our options and know our students, right?
Yeah. Do you think we default so much to the passive one? I mean, it's not to go bad on it, because when lecturing is done really well, it's captivating.
Incredibly so. I mean, we listen to audiobooks, right?
Yeah, we listen to audiobooks. Like, we listen to TED Talks. We listen to that's what, for people of a spiritual persuasion, that's what church is in a lot of ways. It's getting up and listening to someone talk for 40 minutes. That's so many YouTube videos out there that we just want to –
we're doing a podcast right now. That's just a couple of people talking into the ether for 40 minutes to an hour.
Welcome to our podcast episode where we talk to you for 30 minutes about not talking to other people for 30 minutes.
Right.
Now, there is an exchange back and forth, you and yes. me, and that's different. And that to me has always been something from different vantage points of learning that, yeah, why do we default to even from lectures? I love and encourage when instructors bring in guest speakers or bring in guest teachers to come in or have interviews with experts in their field. Or industry experts to have that back and forth, because the diversity of knowledge and the diversity of perspectives helps lift up the overall availability of learning and ideas for students to interact with.
Well, and that's one of the things I actually love about including videos that are not the instructor in online courses,
yes.
whether they come from, you know, the internet realm or that's another faculty member in your department. I love seeing those in courses, because it's like, hey, here's another expert in the field talking to you about this same thing or giving you something else to think about with this topic.
It, to me, counterbalances that sage on the stage mentality, and that it promotes the collaboration of education, that education truly is. Education is a collaborative act. And the more that we as instructors, designers, facilitators of knowledge can demonstrate that and exemplify that, the more dynamic our students are going to be in their learning and their ability to synthesize information, because they see it comes from a plethora of other minds and other ideas and not just this one individual who holds all the keys. And you have to go through that one individual to get the keys to the kingdom, in a sense.
Well, and I think that you hit the nail on the head just now when you said the word collaboration. That's kind of the antidote to sage on the stage. Collaboration being the antidote to sage on the stage, in a way that when your students not only see you collaborating, but also are given the opportunity to collaborate themselves,
yes.
then that's really what takes that to active learning. They're able to move and do and think and kind of grasp and grapple with the knowledge and topic themselves to make it their own and fit it into their own, you know, conceptualization, rather than just hear it one way from what you said and try to fit it into a box of memory, you
yes.
know. It's very different to live it than it is to hear it.
Yes. That makes me think of, I'm going to paraphrase this quote by a man named Dr. Timothy Keller. He was a theologian and a pastor, but I think his idea here translates well into the wider world of learning and education. He says, if you learn or follow only one person, you'll be a clone. Or in a cult. If you learn from and listen to two people, you'll be divided or conflicted. If you start to listen to three or more voices, you're starting to begin the process of education. And so that idea of really taking in multiple ideas, multiple collaborative concepts and ideas from more than one perspective allows you to open up your mind to the differences in how people see even the same concept sometimes.
Yeah. So, actually, that all reminds me of our social learning episode that recently came out as well, where Amelie and I really talked about social learning and, making it, how important it is to kind of build that culture of collaboration in your classroom.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us today on the Pedagogy Toolkit. Be sure to check out the show notes for different details and insights from articles we referenced throughout this episode. And don't forget to subscribe. Thanks.